The new leader of Wisconsin's Democratic Party is here. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Earlier this month, the Democratic Party of Wisconsin picked a former national activist as their new chairman. Ben Wickler recently returned to the state after several years in Washington for MoveOn.org, a liberal group. He takes over the party with a Democrat in the governor's chair, a Republican-controlled state legislature, and split representation in Congress. He joins us this morning to talk about his top priorities and challenges, the unfolding state budget, and how Democrats are preparing for next year's elections. What questions do you have for the new leader of Wisconsin's Democrats? What do you want to know about his positions? What issues do you think Democrats should be working to address in the state? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We should note that the morning show invited the chairman of the state Republican Party to join us this morning, but he couldn't make it, so we will look to have him on another time. Ben Wickler, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, John. It's great to be here. I'm a longtime listener, and I'm very happy to be on the air.
I'm very happy to be on the air, too, so I guess we're both happy. What are your top priorities as the party's new chair?
The way I think of the couple of years ahead of us, I was just elected to a two-year term along with Felicia Martin from Milwaukee and Lee Snodgrass of Appleton. We ran as a ticket. We think there's a five-front fight coming up. And the two of the fronts happen simultaneously, so it's a little complicated. But there's a series of elections. There's also this fight right now on the state budget. So next week, Republicans are planning to try to pass through, you know, this version they just posted, the legislative text of a budget that is kind of a slap in the face to the budget that the governor proposed after holding listening sessions all across Wisconsin with Mandela Barnes, starting right after the election. And the question of whether we'll expand Medicaid, make health care more affordable to Wisconsinites, bring down prices in the private market by expanding Medicaid in the, you know, through the public sector, that is on the line in the next week. So that's the first priority, and that's something that at the Democratic Party we've actually been organizing people in neighborhood teams in Republican legislative districts already over the last few weeks to knock on doors and talk to folks. We're finding that, you know, Republican or Democrat, almost everyone wants to make healthcare more affordable. Almost everyone supports expanding Medicaid, and I'm very concerned that the Republicans in the legislature aren't listening to folks. So that's the first thing. After that, We're going to be fighting on our issues day in and day out, but we're looking at these five big fights. The first one is the spring election next year. There's normally a more conservative electorate in spring elections in Wisconsin. Next year might be different because the presidential primary is on the same day as our spring election. There's a Supreme Court race that day. There are hundreds of local and county offices up for election on that day. And at the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, we are urging people to run for office. We're looking for people who want to represent and help shape the future of their communities all over the state, because this is a day when, you know, you can run and win in places that might be impossible to win in normal electoral conditions. So that's the first thing, a local blue wave in the spring of 2020. And although these offices are nonpartisan, Republicans have not treated them as nonpartisan offices for several decades now. There's been an intentional effort on the Republican side to organize and get people on school boards who deny climate change and, you know, oppose comprehensive sex education for kids. We think this is the time to bring democracy to our local races in the spring. That's the first thing.
I want to go back to the Medicaid question again quickly. If the Republicans don't budge on Medicaid expansion, which they've said they won't, do you think Governor Evers should veto the whole budget bill?
I think the governor is absolutely right to have all options on the table right now. And I think the question of which of those options he'll choose to use is a judgment the governor will make, you know, in light of what's best for the people of Wisconsin. I think right now there's no question that amendments will be proposed on the floor of the state legislature. And this is the moment when the people have the biggest say. We need Republican and Democratic legislators to hear from their constituents about what they want. It's pretty easy to call the Wisconsin legislative hotline. People can make calls and weigh in. And there are open records requests you can file to find out what legislators are hearing from their constituents. There's a website called We the Irrelevant that's been tabulating the constituent responses to different issues. And I think, you know, for a lot of legislators, they've been used to a kind of democracy-free environment where they don't have to pay attention to what people say. But there's going to be a big election next fall, and then there will be new maps. And so democracy will come home to roost, so to speak. I think this is a really vital time for the public to weigh in.
Ben Wickler is the new chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. What do you think he should know? What do you want him to hear? Should Governor Evers veto the state budget bill? Should the governor be more willing to compromise or not to get his way? Share your comments or questions with us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We have a caller on the line. Saeed is calling us from Green Bay. Saeed, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to push back a little bit on this assumption of implication that your speaker made that making healthcare more affordable is the same thing as expanding Medicaid. Those two are not at all connected. There are some very significant problems with expanding Medicaid, namely the people that are charged with providing that service. Our healthcare institutions go at significant financial risk when that happens. And the federal aid that is promised, the $360 million that is promised to try to help in that regard, is not permanent. In fact, it may die out even after the first cycle. And that eventually becomes a Wisconsin taxpayer problem, and it becomes a threat to the financial viability of healthcare institutions that are charged with providing those services.
All right, Saeed, we take your point. Ben Wickler, that is one of the common pushbacks against taking the Medicaid expansion, that it could disappear.
This is the argument you hear over and over from Republicans in the legislature. And if they're following national news, they know that, in fact, Republicans in Congress, including folks like Sean Duffy here in Wisconsin, tried everything they could to end the Medicaid expansion, to take away the Affordable Care Act. They tried to make it not permanent. They tried to fulfill that promise and take away health care from tens of millions of Americans, and they failed. They failed because of a massive grassroots uprising of millions of people. And frankly, I don't see any appetite in Congress anytime soon for running into that brick wall again. The public has spoken. The Congress has spoken. Congress is not going to take away the Medicaid expansion money. And so that funding is there. Now, the question is, will Wisconsin continue just to send it out of the state, or will we bring our dollars back home? The governor's proposal to expand Medicaid would bring $1.6 billion over the next couple of years into Wisconsin. It would save taxpayers $324 million while plugging a huge amount of urgently needed funds into the system. And if you think rural hospitals should stay open, if you think people should be able to get health insurance, and let me emphasize again, if you think private market costs should go down, you want to expand Medicaid. There was an article in Health Affairs, the leading nonpartisan health policy journal, published just a couple weeks ago that looked at Wisconsin and neighboring states that have expanded Medicaid. And they found that in the places where they expanded Medicaid, premiums on the individual market were $57 a month lower than they are here in Wisconsin. Getting people, often the folks with the highest medical costs, onto the Medicaid system reduces the prices for everyone else. It's a win-win-win-win-win. But the Republican budget plan is just a lose-lose.
Saeed, thanks for your call. You could be next at 800-642-1234. Ben Wickler is chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, and he'll stay with us as our conversation continues. We hope to hear from our listeners as well. What should Governor Evers and Democrats be making their top priorities? Where do you see room for Republicans and Democrats to work together? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking with Ben Wickler, the new chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, about his priorities and challenges, the state budget, and next year's elections. What questions or comments do you want to share with him? What issues do you think the Democratic Party should be working to address? What do you think about the unfolding state budget? Where do you see room for Republicans and Democrats to work together? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ben, the Joint Finance Committee rejected Governor Evers' gas tax increase and approved hiking car registration and title fees to fund road repairs. Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss joined our program last week and called the measure a compromise. Do you agree? Can Democrats get behind the fee increases?
There's a compromise in the sense that there's not an intentional effort to deprive our highways and the folks who fix our highways of some amount of funds that we urgently need to fix them and make our roads safer and, you know, less damaging. I do think there's a big missed opportunity because the gas tax would cost a tiny fraction of what people are paying right now to repair their cars. There's an estimate that Wisconsinites pay $657 a year in car repairs because the road conditions are so bad. And the gas tax would cost, maybe $6 a month for the typical Wisconsinite. I think that there's a fundamental question of whether we see investing in our state so that we can grow our state's economy, we can grow opportunities, we can make this a better place, whether that's worth doing or not. And I think it's a fundamental value for Democrats that we believe in investing in Wisconsin. I'm glad that Speaker Voss is noticing the list of priorities, but the kinds of actions he's proposing to do on healthcare and on roads, on public education, they're still far short of what we need. And I think that's why the public's input in this fight is so important. And it's also why the elections next year are going to be so consequential for the state. And that's, while we fight on the legislative battle, we're thinking about next spring, the national convention next summer, and then the fall election with President Trump and also in the legislative chambers. I think a lot of folks don't realize if Republicans flip 3 seats in the state assembly and the state senate, they'll have a veto overriding majority. And that means that they'll be able to pass gerrymandered maps and override the governor's veto to lock in a kind of undemocratic system for another decade. I have a 7-year-old. He'll be graduating from high school before we have democratic representation in the state of Wisconsin if the Republicans have their way. So we're organizing right now for the election at the same time as on the other hand, we're fighting on these issues in the present moment.
We're about halfway through Governor Evers' first year. What do you think the governor's biggest accomplishment so far has been?
One thing that I love that the governor has done is listen. He's a great listener, and it's true of a lot of great educators is that they actually pay attention to the people in front of them. Governor Evers has gone across the state and developed the people's budget. It's a picture of what he would pass, what Democrats would pass if either if Republicans were ready to compromise and really go for the things that folks voted for, but also if the Democratic process worked and lawmakers listened to their constituents. And so there's a slew of different issues that starting with Medicaid expansion is really the cornerstone of the whole thing that folks would want to chime in on. The other thing I really am grateful for is how he's changed the tone in politics in Wisconsin. He's a warm, genuinely kind person. And people see him and they see Mandela Barnes and they see themselves in each of them. They look at our whole statewide ticket, Sarah Godlewski and Josh Call. It's a team that I think brings a kind of optimism and warmth to the state of Wisconsin and a belief that, if we pull together, we can do this. There have been so many years of just intense division coming from the governor's residence. And Governor Evers is not someone who divides people. There's always partisan attempts to kind of go at him with this or that. But this is just a guy that you can think about playing euchre with. And I think it's nice as a state to have a moment to take a breath and take a step back from that kind of partisan warfare at a time when national politics is so angry and bitterly divided.
Let's take a call. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, John. So my question is for your guest, what type of pragmatic steps can both Republicans and Democrats take in the state of Wisconsin to potentially step away from the national dogma of the parties and work more across the aisle to benefit Wisconsinites and focus on Wisconsin specifically?
That's a great question. And it's so easy to get lost in the swirl of national politics. And, you know, I will say, national politics is coming to Wisconsin. It is there. It is here now. But we are likely to be the tipping point state in the presidential election. I think of the next year as this kind of moment, like the end of the first episode of Star Wars, or the, I guess, fourth episode, where the Rebel Alliance gets the plans to the Death Star, and there's one way in to be able to you know, change everything. That's Wisconsin in 2020. So I will say, we're not going to leave national politics out. But here in Wisconsin, there are issues that have broad bipartisan agreement. I think roads is a great example. Expanding Medicaid and healthcare is another great example. Public schools, clean water. This is something you hear about in the heart of Milwaukee, where there are lead lateral pipes that are, you know, bringing really poisonous water to kids, and in rural Wisconsin. I was talking to Senator Patty Schachner yesterday, and there's this proposed CAFO, 26,000 hog confined area feeding operation that will threaten water quality in her, the communities that she represents. These are issues that touch people in their lives, whether they're Republican or Democrat. And what I dream of is a Republican Party that would be a dance partner that would work with Democrats to be able to address these priorities. They are things that don't have to be partisan. Unfortunately, in Wisconsin's political climate right now, they still are. So often Republicans are using these issues that really are just the bread and butter issues of people's lives. They're using them as kind of political opportunities to go after Democrats or obstruct Democratic priorities to prevent Democrats from being able to achieve something. I'd rather be able to work hand in hand with between Democrats and Republicans to make a difference in people's lives. That's the point of politics.
Marcus, thanks for your call. Let's go to the opposite corner of the state and hear from Tom up in Port Wing. Tom, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. My question is, everybody talks a good game about gerrymandering right up until they get in power. What exactly would this look like, the addressing of gerrymandering, other than a lot of hot air while out of power for the Democrats? I would like to hear what is being proposed to address the issue.
All right, Tom, thanks for that question. So what is the Democratic plan to fix the gerrymandering problem?
The Democratic plan to fix the gerrymandering problem is in the governor's budget. Governor Evers and Mandela Barnes and the Democratic administration proposed switching away from gerrymandering towards a nonpartisan system like the one in Iowa that would produce results that actually reflect what voters want, where voters pick their legislators instead of legislators picking their voters. That is something that almost everyone wants. Majorities of Republicans and majorities of Democrats want it in Wisconsin. If Democrats, you know, in the last election cycle, 54% of votes for state assembly went to Democratic candidates, but Republicans got 63 out of the 99 seats because of gerrymandering, because of these maps that were intentionally drawn to benefit Republicans. If we had had a Democratic legislature right now, we would end gerrymandering in this budget session. It would be gone. And I think it's easy to become cynical because we have a system that's built to withstand public opinion and public pressure. That is on the line. That is on the ballot next year, fundamentally. Because, again, if Republicans get three more seats in the state assembly, if they get 66 votes, if they get three more seats in the state Senate and they have 22 out of the 33 seats, they will be able to override the governor's veto of gerrymandered maps and then lock in gerrymandered maps until 2032. So if you believe that we should have fair maps in the state of Wisconsin, which is a core Democratic principle, I was at the Democratic convention. I think we passed a resolution in support of ending gerrymandering. Democrats don't want a system where if Democrats take over, then we reshape the maps to benefit Democrats. Democracy is in the Democratic Party's name. We think that we can win in a fair playing field and a battle of ideas. It's right now, and this is not true everywhere, but right now in Wisconsin, the Republican Party is fighting to defend gerrymandered maps. We think that's just a terrible way to go, and we want to end it.
Last question. What kind of Democrat carries Wisconsin in next year's presidential race? Someone in the center who connects with the independent voters, or someone who is more left and rallies the base?
I tend to think to win, you need to both be able to get people excited who are following politics really closely and also reach out to people who you know, who might not be tuning in or might sometimes go either way. And victories tend to come when you have both things. I will say that the fundamental thing is that I urge. I've spoken to many of the presidential candidates. I want them to come to Wisconsin. I want them to spend time here listening. I want them to come to Madison and Milwaukee and also Superior and visit you in the studio there and come all over the state in rural areas and urban areas and suburbs alike. The important thing in life and in politics is showing up. And that's what we're going to do at the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. That's what we want our presidential candidates to do, whether it's to communities of color, or to you know, folks in very rural areas who haven't heard from a presidential candidate in a while.
Ben, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ben Wickler is chairman of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Coming up, we find out why some television stations are now playing our national anthem once a day. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. This week, Gray Television, which has stations in 93 markets across the U.S., started airing the national anthem on a daily basis.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light?
Before the advent of 24/7 operations, it was common to hear the national anthem on TV at sign-on and sign-off, along with language describing the station's license parameters and so forth. Well, we're going to get into the history and meaning of the practice and find out why it's starting up again. Do you think local TV stations should play the national anthem or not? Why do you think so? Why do you think not? Maybe you think it doesn't matter whether they played or not. Did you notice that they stopped? Do you think the national anthem has become political? How and why? What does it mean to you? What's your reaction when the national anthem is played on a local TV or radio station? Let us know. Share your thoughts with us at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jane Kirtley is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. Jane, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
This week, Gray Television started airing the national anthem every morning at 4 a.m. to signal the end of the broadcast day and the beginning of the next. The video itself features patriotic imagery like farmlands, people with American flags, and people in military uniforms. Why is this significant?
Well, I think it depends on your age, whether you think it's significant or not. Older people like me do remember, as you said in your opener, that this used to be a very common practice, either at the beginning or the end of the broadcast day, in the era before 24/7 programming. It sort of stopped after the Vietnam War, and more particularly during the 1980s, when there was a lot of deregulation on the part of the Federal Communications Commission, eliminating probably most famously the Fairness Doctrine. However, there's never been a prohibition on doing it, of course, and after the 9/11 attacks, a number of stations started airing it again, either in the morning or at the end of the day. And some people may not be aware that there are actually stations around the country, notably in the South, but not exclusively, that air the national anthem at 12 noon every day. So I guess my point would be that this is not in and of itself a new phenomenon. It's just that I think given the reach that Gray has, as you said, they have 93 properties spread out all over the country, the fact that they've made this a system-wide policy, does suggest a shift. And I think the question really is, how is it to be interpreted?
Yeah, and to be clear, there was never any requirement that stations broadcast the national anthem as part of their sign-on and sign-off routine, was there?
Well, that's a good question. And when I first heard about this, I went back and tried to do some research about it. A couple of things to keep in mind. When the Star Spangled Banner was made the national anthem, that was in 1931. Of course, we really only had commercial radio at that point. Television hadn't really come into play in any kind of meaningful way. There were some experimental stations, but it wasn't widespread the way it is today. The Communications Act of 1934 did not address this, but I have read at least one source that suggests that after the Pearl Harbor attacks, that there was a recommendation from the government that stations start broadcasting the national anthem. Whether there was a direction or whether it was just a choice, I don't really know. But in any event, there's no question that it was certainly not required after the war.
Let's take a call here. Carmen joins us from Milwaukee. Carmen, good morning. Welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Like I said previously, I feel it still should be broadcast. I'm a native of Germany, and I think this is part of your history, part of your culture. I don't take any offense to it. I think this would make this country great and proud, and I don't see it political at all. I think politics should be taken out of the equation. I think we're actually making it more towards the armed forces, which I am a previous life of somebody in the armed forces, and I do think we should keep doing it and honoring our service members.
All right, Carmen, thanks thanks for that. What comment do you have to say to what Carmen had to say?
Well, you know, it's quite common in many other countries to play the national anthem. Of course, many broadcasters in other countries are state-owned, so it's not really optional for them to do that. But no question that it can have a message of national solidarity and so forth. I guess the thing that troubles me about this, and I am, you know, I wish that the national anthem really were as non-political as Carmen is suggesting that it ought to be, but the reality is it has shifted into a highly politicized thing, especially given the playing of the national anthem at sporting events like football, National Football League tournaments, things like that. And, you know, the issue of honoring the military, I think, is another interesting aspect of this because, of course, the national anthem is not exclusively something that is supposed to honor the military. It is a national anthem for everybody in this country. But it's quite true that if you look at the gray version that is airing, although they do have, scenes of the United States and young people and so forth, they also prominently figure those in the military. If they want to support the military, of course, that is absolutely their right, and that's fine. But, you know, there is this question of exactly what is the national anthem supposed to be for? Does it have a particular purpose tied especially to honoring the military, or is it something for everybody in this nation?
Let's talk a little bit more about Gray TV. You said they're in 93 markets across the state. They have four stations in Wisconsin, Madison, Green Bay, Wausau, and Eau Claire. What else can you tell us about Gray TV?
Well, I think one thing that some people may not be aware of is that Gray, like a number of broadcast groups, has network affiliations kind of across the spectrum. They have NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, and even the kind of sub-channels like MeTV and CW. So if people are looking at this and thinking, oh, they must be affiliated with one network or another across the board, they're not. And I think that's an important thing to be aware of. But I will say that they do some original programming that they create and originate themselves. And starting later this year, they're going to be having a show with Greta Van Susteren, who, of course, for many years was on CNN and then at Fox. And I think most people probably consider her on at least the libertarian and perhaps the conservative side. I'm not suggesting that one program necessarily defines a political viewpoint or anything like that, but I think it's Gray has shown itself in the past to be sort of on the center-right side of the spectrum.
Compare them then to Sinclair.
Well, I think Sinclair, from my perspective, is probably more on the conservative side. But putting politics aside, I think the distinction that I would draw, or probably the contrast that I would draw, is that there was quite a bit of discussion last year when Sinclair Broadcast Group basically sent out a script that was to be read by its local anchors, talking about fake news and some other issues, which a lot of observers found to be kind of creepy in the sense that they were dictating what their local affiliates or their local stations were supposed to be saying about a particular topic. I'm not aware that Gray has done something similar to this, other than this idea of playing the Star Spangled Banner.
Why do you think Gray is choosing to do this right now?
That's a great question, and I think you would have to ask them. What they've said in their press release is that this is all about reinstating something that they think should never have ceased to be. And it's an interesting question, isn't it, about why it stopped, whether it was a political move on the part of stations or whether it was simply a commercial viewpoint, the idea that there was a time where stations went off the air during the early morning hours, and there was a period of time where all you saw was a test pattern, and it was a way to start and end your broadcast day. When that ceased to be the case, they stopped playing the national anthem. What Gray says is that they're trying to express their patriotism, and I think until we learn otherwise, we have to take them at their word on that.
I've been in radio long enough to remember sign on and sign off and all the routines you went through. And when you came in the morning, you turned on the transmitter and then you played the anthem and then you read the statement about your station's broadcast day and all of that. And the same thing happened in the evening. And not all television stations played the anthem, though, particularly when they signed off. Many chose to air a poem set to music. I forget, it was about flight. I don't remember the name of it, but it was quite stirring. But it was just something you did, and nobody said anything about it. Do you think it says something about how we are, how we think about these things now that we're even having this discussion?
Well, I think it is an interesting question, isn't it? Because again, I'm old enough to have grown up in the era of a lot of use of the national anthem in a variety of settings. Certainly at public school events, things like that, and certainly the Pledge of Allegiance. And there was this degree of sort of overt patriotism as manifested by those kinds of things, which I think many in the country supported. But the factionalism that developed, particularly during the Vietnam War, I think started to change things. I mean, we remember things like the reaction of Olympic athletes at the playing of the national anthem, all kinds of things that have basically turned these national symbols into things that are not simply expressions of solidarity, but can be used as a litmus test of how patriotic you are or you aren't. I think the tricky part for any kind of broadcaster during the era, for example, of the Fairness Doctrine would have been a question of whether this is really a political expression rather than a kind of neutral patriotic expression. Since the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine, there's no obligation to give those with opposing viewpoints an opportunity to be heard, so you wouldn't have to bring in somebody who opposes this to comment on it. It gives stations a lot more freedom to make these decisions.
Jane Kirtley is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. She stays with us as our conversation continues. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. This week, Gray Television, which has stations in 93 markets across the U.S., started airing the national anthem on a daily basis. Before the advent of 24/7 operations, it was common to hear the national anthem on TV or a recitation of John Gillespie McGee's High Flight. This would be done at the beginning or the end of the broadcast day. We're getting into the history and meaning of this practice and finding out why playing the national anthem is starting up again. Our guest is Jane Kirtley, who is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. Do you think local TV stations should play the anthem or not? Why or why not? Maybe you don't think it matters whether they play it or not. Do you think the national anthem has become political? How and why? What does it mean to you? What's your reaction when the anthem is played on local television or on a radio station? Do you think it doesn't have any place there, or do you think it's perfectly okay? Or maybe you think the national anthem isn't political, but that people have made it so, or it's become more political in recent years. Give us your thoughts on local TV stations playing it at 800-642-1234. Playing the national anthem was routine for broadcasters. Do we know? Well, we talked about this earlier. There was no actual requirement that it was played, but after Pearl Harbor, stations were urged to play it. Was this to increase the amount of nationalistic feeling among the populace?
Well, you know, there were a lot of requirements that were put in place after the war, although to use requirement is probably expressing it a little too strongly, because interestingly, the Office of War Information, which we could kind of think of as a censorship bureau, had a list of things that it didn't want stations to report on or do, and there were inquiries, and most of them actually came up because of weather reports. Surprisingly, maybe not so surprisingly, there were really concerns that if stations were broadcasting weather reports, that it would give those on the enemy side information that would be useful for them if they were planning some kinds of attacks. So oddly enough, during the Second World War, weather reporting was very limited except for official bulletins from what was then the National Weather Bureau. This happened after a terrible series of tornadoes in Memphis, Tennessee, killed a bunch of people, and the stations hadn't been allowed to broadcast anything about it. But for the most part, the directives were towards things that were seen as information that would be useful for the enemy or could be used by the enemy. For example, call-in shows where you could request the playing of a particular song, stations were strongly discouraged from permitting those kinds of things. But in all my research, I really couldn't find anything that explicitly said they had to play the national anthem, although one source says that they did. But in any event, whether they did or not, were required to it, they did do it. And it continued, as I said, well into the 1960s, but at that point it started to drop off, with the big drop-off being two things: deregulation by the FCC, the elimination of the Fairness Doctrine, and again, I think most importantly at all, the rise of 24-hour broadcasting.
And the other thing here was also the demise of the National Association of Broadcasters Code of Conduct, which was something that stations subscribed to until it was found to be a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act.
That's right, a violation of the antitrust laws, which you know, and again, if you watch old television shows, you'll still see at the end of them that this particular production company subscribes to the NAB standards.
And has their seal of approval. Yeah.
Exactly,
And we could get into another area on that, but we won't. Sharon from Hinckley wanted to know if there was any funding coming from outside sources paying to play the national anthem on television. Do we know anything about that?
As far as Gray is concerned, not to my knowledge. I think this is a decision that has been made by the corporation itself. And again, as far as I know, and I could be mistaken, but to my knowledge, all of the stations, particularly, as I said, in the South that have been airing this at 12 noon, have been doing it of their own volition.
Today, some people say playing the national anthem on television as an inherently political act. Have the national anthem and other expressions of patriotism always been seen as political or controversial in the way that they are by some people today?
Well, I think the answer is if we go back, and history tells us that the playing of I shouldn't say the national anthem, because as I said, the Star Spangled Banner didn't become the national anthem until 1931. But for example, during the Civil War, it was very common in the North to play something like Columbia, the Gem of the Ocean, or some other patriotic song. In the South, of course, it was Dixie, and there's still stations in the South that will play Dixie and did play Dixie even in the 60s and 70s. So is that a political act? Is it a expression of historical solidarity? You know, I think it's in the eye of the listener.
We may never know, and we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us, Jane Kirtley, a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota.
Thank you so much.
Just north of Milwaukee and Shorewood, people were stunned to learn that an iconic mansion overlooking Lake Michigan is scheduled to be torn down and that the owner is Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abel. He's planning to build a brand new house on the site. The village cannot prevent the demolition, but as Jane Hamden reports, residents are lobbying to save the 1927 estate.
The home is a grand Mediterranean revival made of stone with a terracotta roof. It's the work of Wisconsin architect Alexander Eschweiler. 8 bedrooms and 7 baths, filled with fine wood finishes, a pipe organ in the living room, and a sweeping staircase.
Each tread of the staircase is a solid piece of marble. It has all hand-wrought iron railings that were designed by him.
Sarah Hambrook grew up in the house with 5 brothers and sisters. Her family lived there for 33 years, and last fall sold it to Abley for $2.6 million. They had no idea he planned to demolish it.
My sister, Lauren, actually was on Facebook and saw a post from Habitat for Humanity Restore. We're so excited to salvage this 1920s mansion, and it had photographs attached to it. And she thought, oh my gosh, that's our house.
At the Restore, the ornate ironwork, lighting, and cabinets sold fast. In Shorewood, angry residents called the village and started an online petition to save the mansion.
It feels so extreme. I'm kind of floored by it.
Rosie Braydeck organized a letter-writing night at a local pub urging the Milwaukee County executive to reconsider. Joan Gorman helped out.
When you live in a small house and you grow up in a village, you have buildings that are a touchstone that remind you of the time, the elegance, the people, and this is one of those properties.
In some Wisconsin communities, there are formal protections for touchstone buildings. In Milwaukee, if someone wants to tear down a mansion, it's not that easy to do. Carlin Hatala works with the city's Historic Preservation Commission.
There are definitely steps so that there's an opportunity for public input, and so the public can be heard.
Milwaukee is one of 72 Wisconsin cities and towns that are certified in preservation through a federal program that can slow down the process and offer alternatives to demolition. But most places, like Shorewood, don't have any protections. If homeowners like Abley follow the rules, local communities can't stop them.
He can do what he wants with it, within reason.
Supporters of the homeowners' property rights are having their say, too. Bob Schumacher was serving up drinks at the Shorewood Men's Club Chicken Barbecue.
He paid the money. He's going to put up a new house. So the $2.6 million he spent with the new house, that property will probably be $5 or $6 million, which means he has to pay more taxes.
But critics say the history is far more valuable than the tax revenue. Celeste Carroll is a UW-Madison student. She grew up in Shorewood and toured the mansion when she was a teenager.
So I was 15. I remember being in there. I specifically remember this ballroom. I think it had like windows in it. And I don't know. I just like to picture what a gathering would have looked like in that ballroom.
The house inspired Carroll, and now she's an intern at the Shorewood Historical Society.
And to me, the fact that someone is making this choice to raise this landmark is such a shame. It doesn't need to happen. Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should.
The Milwaukee County executive did not respond to requests for comment, but in a statement, he said he and his fiancée love the neighborhood, and they're committed to a new design that respects and honors it. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Jane Hamden.
This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.